everyone. You're listening to Operation Dichotomy. I'm Paul. I'm your host, and we are the bridge between perception and reality. Our goal here is to create a society of greater understanding and empathy where people are slower to speak and more eager to listen and hear the other perspective. We think that even with just that small shift in the way that we interact with people, we're going to solve a lot of the problems that we see around us today. So if that sounds like something that you are interested in and can get behind, you can learn more about us at operationdichotomy.com, or you can follow us at Instagram, follow us on Instagram at Operation Dichotomy, or Operation Dichotomy at Facebook as well. If you have found any value in our podcast and in our content, we do ask that you share that with people who you think will also vibe with it or benefit from it. I think that's one easy way for you guys to make an impact in your communities, just by sharing the stuff that we do. If you don't value it, then maybe you'll value today's conversation. So thanks for coming back. So today we have an awesome guest. He has quite a story, and I'm sure you guys are going to learn a lot about, a lot about. His name is Nigel Tang. He is a man with multiple AA degrees, multiple undergraduate certificates. He has a bachelor's degree. He is currently on the way to getting an MBA. He is AOD certified. And for those of you who don't know what that means alcohol and other drugs counseling. He's trained as a transformational coach. But the coolest thing about all of that is that he completed all of this while he was incarcerated. And maybe that surprises you. Maybe that doesn't. We'll talk about that in our conversation today. But without further ado, Nigel, thank you for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate your time, man. I know that I'm going to have a hard time asking you questions just because I feel like my mouth is going to be open, jaw dropped while listening to you speak. But again, just thank you for the vulnerability that you have in sharing your story. That being said, can we start just talking about you? The turning point, I think we kind of know, will come when you talk about how you ended up in prison. But let's start with your childhood. What was your childhood like? How did you grow up? And kind of walk us through that process so we can see where you're coming from.
Okay. I'm a child of immigrant parents. Came over here from, I was born in Hong Kong in a refugee camp. My parents are both born in Vietnam. I'm of a Chinese and Vietnamese background. We lived in New York for a bit, then we moved over to California. So basically growing up when I was around 6 years old, really young, I did really well in first grade. Second grade, my dad enrolled me into Chinese school and he started to teach me multiplication. I remember early on, my dad was a very strict authoritarian parent. My relationship with my father was always very distant. I never really felt close to my dad. Even when he was teaching me multiplication, it was, if I would get a question wrong, he would hit me in the head. And that would go on for like basically once a week on Saturday for about 30, 40 minutes. I remember just really hating the experience of learning. And that went on for a while. Then we moved to California, and when I was in California, you know, I started running away from home a lot. The constant put down by my father of how dumb I was, why can't I be like other kids? And, you know, the abuse continued. And, you know, I just hung out in the streets, fell with the wrong crowd. I just continued that way for a while, just pretty much, I guess you can say, a problem child. About when I was 8 years old, there was one incident where I was hanging out with my friend, older kids. He was a neighbor, and it was a shooting. I saw my friend got shot really close to me. I remember running away from the gunman, and at 8 years old, I remember just being really scared. And I remember that incident, how it impacted me, where I just thought that, you know, I wasn't, it was, the world was a very scary place. I didn't know if I would even live, you know, like a long life or whatever. And so the whole thing of like going to school and, you know, having a plan and all that, it was just not really something that I thought was for me. You know, I just thought like at any day I could lose my life. Also the experience with my dad teaching me multiplication as well as Chinese characters was very oppressive. So I continued to basically live my life on the streets up until when I was about 10 or 11. I remember my dad said something to me that was really profound, I guess. He said that, "I'm gonna stop hitting you now. It seemed like all the beatings I give you isn't helping." And he said that, "I'm gonna let," so he basically said, I'm giving up on you. And he said that, I'm gonna show you that life is gonna beat you harder than I ever can. So while on one hand I was relieved that my dad isn't gonna hit me anymore, but it was replaced with this other sort of this emotional abandonment that my father said, you know, he's given up on me. So I just kind of continue on just living on the streets. I ran away a lot constantly. I didn't like being around my dad. So I just hung around with you know, like a bad crowd. Eventually I got involved with hanging around with gang members and that sort of thing, got involved with drugs, committing crimes and that sort of thing. And 2 days after my 13th birthday, I went to juvenile hall. And I went to a group home for about a year or so. Then I got out. And then I 3 weeks later, I got arrested and for carrying a concealed weapon. And I went to a camp, what they call like a juvenile detention camp. I did a year there, I got out. 3 months afterwards, I got busted again for burglary, and I went back to another juvenile detention camp. And I should say that while I was in these juvenile hall, juvenile system, I became much more violent. The culture of violence there is very prevalent. I learned to be tough. A lot of times, especially in those earlier years, where many times I would be in a unit where I was the only Asian kid. Mm. And so a lot of times I learned that I would fight a lot of other kids, whether they call me a racial slur or, you know, whatever the case may be, try to pick on me. And so I learned to just get in fights more often so that I can show the other kids in that unit that like I'm not someone to be messed with. And that way, like if you let one person bully you, then and you don't do nothing about it, then you bring on this sort of group bullying, right? So you get bullied by other kids. So for me to prevent that, what I would do is just get in a fight with the kids there first, whoever just say the first thing, who said anything disrespectful or whatever. And that was my sort of defense mechanism to ward off group bullying. And with time, that strategy developed into where I develop an identity that closely associate with this sort of tough guy image, with being violent. And so a lot of that, I took with me that sort of culture from juvenile hall to out to the street. And I guess it played well with the whole, you know, gangster image and that sort of thing. And growing up, I watched a lot of like, you know, those Chinese triad movies.
Yeah.
And I thought they were like the coolest thing ever, you know, and sometimes those Italian movies, gangster movies that you would see like, oh, everybody respected them and how they have so much control and that sort of thing. And so I guess as a kid growing up, I aspired to that. And so up until... after that, I got out from my last juvenile camp detention. I was out for about 8 months, maybe 9 months. And then I finally got arrested for a road rage incident that led to a first degree murder that landed me a 35 year to life sentence. So I went to prison when I was 18 years old. Yeah. And yeah, it was a pretty scary experience when I first got there. And yeah.
So I feel like, excuse me, there's a lot of different things happening at one time while you're growing up. There's obviously your dad, where I won't really try to question his intentions or anything like that for the purposes of our conversation today. Sure. But obviously the way that he treated you had an impact on the way that you grew up, on the way that you felt, especially that moment where you were like, "Dang, he's given up." And I mean, that's harsh words and scary words to any kid growing up, but to have that. And on top of that, you were going through, maybe, I mean, they're obviously related, I feel like, because your dad treated you that way. You didn't feel safe at home. So therefore you're finding community out on the streets and finding camaraderie among people that, you know, maybe you shouldn't have been hanging out with. But I think one of the interesting things that you make me think about as you share your story is the whole juvenile detention center. Mm-hmm. I would think that people go there to recover. I mean, that's the right word, like almost rehab. Yeah, reform. Yeah. Yeah. These kids go there because they don't want these children to behave this way anymore. Mm-hmm. Out, and they'll be model citizens or people who've learned their lesson. Mm-hmm. But it almost seems like it does the opposite, where it reinforces the negative behavior. I don't know if that's systemic, or what do you think about that part from your experience?
From my experience, I think that there's a lack of structure in these juvenile detention system. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of times when I go to school there, I don't know how is it now, because it's almost like 20 years ago, right? 20 something plus years ago. Yeah. But back then I remember just going to school many times, the teacher would just put in a video and you just watch some kind of movie and they'll just leave you alone. And I guess they just figure that's a way to pacify us, you know, where we were preoccupied with watching a movie. Whereas if kids were bored, they might end up fighting each other. Mm. And because there are also fights that breaks out in classrooms as well.
Right.
And I think that there's just not enough teachers that felt like they care enough to really want to make an impact on the kids' lives. A lot of times, just the kids there just feels like no one really cares. Mm-hmm. You know, you just go there, you wake up, you go through the motions, and you go to these classes, and you just basically hang around with other, you know, fellow juvenile delinquents, and you're just talking about the stuff you done on the streets, and just basically glorifying what you guys done, you know, like in terms of crimes and that sort of thing. Mm. And there's nothing about, like, there's no talks about what's your future going to be like. There's no talks about, are you planning to go to college by these teachers? Are you wanting to turn your lives around? There's resources that you can go to. There's really none of that. Mm. And so I remember just going there, just coming out even worse.
Mm. Can I ask you about that road rage incident? What happened?
Sure. I can't get too specific.
Sure.
Just given out of respect for the victim's family. Mm-hmm. But it was basically where me and my crime partner, where we cut off another car by accident. And then the other car accelerated and we have an exchange of words, heated words. Mm. And being 17 years old at that time, and I wasn't high at the time, but I was definitely high the night before and the night before then. Mm. So I don't know, like, maybe there was some fogginess in my mind and a poor judgment on my part, but not to say that was an excuse, but I definitely didn't feel like I was high in the moment. Mm. But I was already, I guess you can say, an angry kid, and there was things that were said, you know, and it happened so fast, like under 30 seconds, within the span of four blocks. And it just like that, like it's so fast and it just happened in a spur of moment. And I'm responsible for murdering a man. And I, yes, as a gang member at the time, I carried a gun and I opened fire and I shot and killed a man. And so I'm definitely responsible for the choice I made that day and the pain that I caused him and his family and his loved ones and the community. So I am definitely responsible for that. There's no excuse for what I've done. I was a very, I guess you can say at the time, a very self-absorbed, selfish, self-entitled, just a violent person, you know, and just no excuse for what I've done.
When, what was the state of your mind when you got into prison as a, you said you got incarcerated at age 18?
I was incarcerated at age 17, but I got sentenced when I was 18.
Okay.
And about like 2 months before I turned 19, I went to prison.
You've been in and out of juvie before, but was it, I mean, I assume it's different going to prison as an adult. And you said 35 to life was your sentence. So generally, do people, I guess for people like me who don't quite understand the nuances of all these things, when you say 35 to life, what are the chances that you get life? And then what are the chances that you can get out before that? What does that even mean?
So when I first got to prison in a level 4 maximum security prison, I remember there was two guys, one with 7 years to life and another guy with 15 years to life. Hmm. And they both been in prison for 30 plus years.
Oh.
And so I remember him telling me, you need to forget about the outside world. You need to forget about your family. You need to forget about your friends. You need to just focus here and now. This is your world now. This is the world you live in here now. You're not going to go home. Just look at me. I got, you know, the guy was like, I got 7 years to life and I've been here 30 plus years. Mm-hmm. And there's another guy that's sitting next to him, 15 years to life and been here over 30 plus years and they're old and gray. And I thought in that moment, like, shit, I just might die in prison. So what it means to have 35 years to life, it's you're supposed to serve out at least 30 years. For me, 30 years. And only after 30 years, maybe they'll let me go after going to what they call the parole board of hearing. And so they go there and they basically evaluate and assess your what you've done with your time in prison and deem if you're still a threat to society or not. And that's all very arbitrary, you know, and that's why a lot of these guys get denied parole. Like some guys in there got denied parole like 10 times. And so for me, I remember thinking, like, what chance do I have, you know, when these guys in level 4 are just basically stuck there for basically what seemed like their whole life. And so it was a very dark time for me, a very depressing time for me. And it was harsh.
So the man that I see now is completely different from the 17, 18 year old kid that ends up in prison for 35 years to life. But when you first got there, of course you were in a bad place, in dark times, depressed, because you're looking at the rest of your life in prison.
Absolutely.
At what point did that change? Like there must have been a turning point somewhere where you began the journey to become the Nigel Tang that you are today.
It took a lot of self-reflection. I remember, I think one of the things that I don't think people hear about a lot, and probably, you know, people won't get, I won't get any sympathy, and not that I'm looking for any sympathy, but it's people that, such as myself, I can't speak for everybody who committed the heinous crime that I did, but I can speak for myself that the sort of shame that comes with taking a life and you're sitting in prison thinking about it every day, the shame you bring on your family, and just knowing that, just the realization that you just took something of great value from the world, it weighs on you. There is a pain that comes with it. There is a pain that comes with the shame. And for the longest, I just couldn't even forgive myself. And not to say I fully forgive myself now, but it's a struggle still.
Yeah.
But for a long time in prison, that's what I had to deal with. And it was eating at me just every day of my life while I was in prison. And at some point, I guess you can say this crucible that I was going through, I thought like, wow, I took a life. Now, what am I going to do? Am I going to just continue to just rot in prison and not do anything of value, not add any value to the world, not do anything productive, just taking up space and oxygen, just wasting taxpayers' money just to feed me and clothe me in prison? Like that very idea, it just didn't sit well with me. And it was a time where, I guess you can say, my turning point started where I actually seriously thought about committing suicide when I was in prison, because I just didn't want to be like this burden onto the world as a whole, like just this overall burden on my family, on taxpayer, on just everybody. And so I did a lot of reading. Even my education has helped. I read tons of like psychology books, sociology books, philosophy, things of that nature. And slowly I started realizing that I don't have to be this person, this sort of non-value adding person. I can do something, but it was slow. And I knew that I didn't want to be the person that I was, but I was still struggling with, while being incarcerated, I didn't know who I wanted to become. So it was this slow process for me. But I think just the fact that I felt such remorse for what I've done, like that just continued to help push me to this sort of self-discovery, this constant looking for ways to be a better person, even while in prison. And so I continue on with my education. Whatever educational opportunity that was available, I took it. Even the time when there was this new program, the AOD program, mm-hmm. that opened up and allowed to train convicts to become addiction counselors, I took that opportunity. And, you know, and the reason why I thought that was a great idea to give as a way to give back, I lost a friend to an overdose. I lost an uncle to drinking. So I thought like, this would be a good way for me to give back, to try to help others with their addiction. Mm. And while I was doing training for that, I also was continuing my education. I basically, asked my dad, begged my dad to help me with getting my bachelor's degree with the help of my sister. So I continued my education. I got a bachelor's in sociology. And while I was doing the AOD program, there was a prerequisite where you have to be also trained as a transformational coach, which was really amazing for me. Mm. One of the things that stood out, I think there was a long time that I really blamed my dad for me being in prison. Or I blamed where I grew up at, or I blamed just everything. And then it was just moment of clarity where I decided that, you know what, I'm not gonna blame anybody for why I'm in prison. I'm gonna take full responsibility for all the results I get in my life. I don't care what it is, whatever results that I have is a direct consequence of my actions. And so when I fully embraced that, then I started really seeing the transformation and the change that occur. And so with that, I continue on with my training as a transformational coach, thanks to my trainer, Jesse Bonderman, who was really nice to volunteer his time to come into prison to train us, whereas other people would have to pay money on the streets to get trained as a coach. Mm. So it was really a blessing, and to see kindness up front in person like that. I don't think I experienced too many kindness in my lifetime. And not to say that they weren't kind people, but looking back on it, I can't really think of any that really stood out for me. And so for this man to come in prison, he really made an impact in my life to show me what compassion looked like for people such as myself who really don't deserve any, just for the heinous crime that I committed. And the fact that he still came to prison to train us, it really showed me that I too can be like him to give back, and despite what I've done. And so I continued with the training. I went on getting my AOD certification while in prison. I went on to finishing my bachelor's degree, although I finished my last few assignments while I got out. Mm. But I essentially finished all my requirements, so I got all my educational goals achieved while I was in prison. And while I was in prison, there was a bill called the SB 260, which is if you were a juvenile who committed your crime, you will automatically go to the board after 25 years. And so with that, I was scheduled to go to the board at the end of 2020. But the reason why I was able to get out about two years earlier, go to the board 2 years earlier was, thanks to the help to some lawyers from Juvenile Innocent and Fair Sentencing Clinic, they took my case as pro bono. Professor Hawthorne and Marissa Sachs and the rest of the folks, too many to name, but they came to help me. They came and visit me while I was in prison, and they really helped me through that last leg of my journey in prison. And so they filed what you call commutation requests. And so Governor Jerry Brown looked at my file and see the work that I was doing while I was in prison. While I was in prison, I also was volunteering my time to do facilitation work as a facilitator or coaching people in the sort of self-help group. Mm-hmm. I was in a self-help group called Cornerstone with the Phoenix Alliance group in prison. And what that was is just basically I was helping other men who was in prison, who's struggling to get clear in their vision on who they want to become, and help them change the way they see themselves so that they can become better men when they're getting out of prison. And so I think with all the work that was done, and as well as my educational attainment, Jerry Brown saw that, that I earned an opportunity to go to the board earlier than scheduled so that I can present my case to the board and see if they still find me a threat to society, and just based on the stuff that I've done, if I was the same person or not. And so apparently they did, which is why you see me here today with you. Oh. And I got out. And yeah, I still have the letter from Jerry Brown. So I was blessed in that way.
Yeah, congratulations. I mean, you went in there thinking 35 to life, and instead you got on 23 because of all the stuff that you were able to do while in prison.
Yeah.
I think you said something very important in the beginning, and then you kind of brought up again now, was this idea of having a vision of who you wanted to become. Mm. And a lot of times it sounds like that's what keeps people in prison. And then the people who have an idea of what they want to become, they're the ones that progress and are able to get out. Mm. At what point did you get an idea of who you wanted to become? Because I feel like that was where you're like looking at your life and your situation and seeing that, hey, I want to become this, but mm-hmm. right now I'm far from it. So let me take the steps necessary to get there, which in itself is an amazing story that says a lot about you in a good way. But when did you figure out what you wanted to become, and what was it that you wanted to become?
I think once I got enrolled into the AOD program and I was receiving my transformational coaching training, I realized that I wanted to become someone of service I wanted to become like a social worker, right? I was interested in the coaching field, but I also liked the idea of being a social worker. And, you know, I growing up when I was a juvenile, I felt like there wasn't enough mentors or people to talk to me, you know, that sort of thing to guide me in the right direction. And I thought like, when I get out, my trainer, Jesse Bonderman, he's such a great guy, great influence on me. I look to him and I think to myself, the kind of work that he does is the kind of work I want to do. It may not look exactly like what he's doing, but I wanted to do something in the realm of like social work, like either like through mental health counseling or just, you know, being some juvenile advocate or something, but something in that realm where you can help people, you know, to see that there's another way, you know. And whereas when I was a kid, I just didn't see another way, and to help them get clear on their purpose in terms of their vision for themselves. And I think as a kid, I wasn't clear. I didn't know there was another way, or maybe that was the excuse I told myself, but it felt like my vision for myself back then was to be like this, the gangsters that you see on TV. When had someone told me, hey, maybe there's another way. Maybe you're not stupid like your dad said you were. Maybe you are capable of doing these things. Maybe you should participate in these clubs or whatever. Maybe, you know, things like that. And I think it would have helped me a great deal. And so the vision I had for myself was I was going to get out and I was going to be a social worker or something in the mental health field or something. And that was something that really drove me to keep my mind straight, which is, and it aligns with my education background, having a sociology degree. I have tons of psychology classes under my belt as well. And all that with the AOD training, it really plays well together to go into the mental health field. And so I thought, like, wouldn't it be great if I could become a social worker? Mm. And so that's the vision I had for myself. And that was the purpose for myself. Whether I actually become a social worker or not, I don't know, but I'll keep trying. Mm-hmm. But I definitely, you know, not really to give up, you know, I'm just going to keep doing what I have to do to reach my goal. And that's what kept me going while I was in prison.
Mm. Sounds like to me, your goal is to, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but sure, it sounds like you want to serve people in the way that you didn't have while you were growing up, but then later you saw good examples in prison, like your coach and these different organizations that were able to provide help for people in your situation.
Yeah.
I personally think you will become what you want to become, but if not, I still feel like you're going to impact a lot of people just by sharing your story. And like you said, telling people that there are other ways. You don't have to go down the same path that I did.
Yeah.
There's another way. Maybe you could try that out. I said this before, but I feel like there aren't enough stories of reformation and change, rehabilitation, if you will, from a young man who was, I mean, you're young and stupid, right?
Like, yeah.
Kids are young and stupid as it is, but then you add issues with parents and environmental situations, it gets way worse.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's hard. It's hard to grow out of that into who you are today. So I just want to say, man, it's kind of weird to say because I don't know you too well, but it's just I feel so proud as someone on this side to be able to see you and meet you and see and hear about the path that you went on to get to where you're at today, Nigel. It's an amazing story.
Thank you.
I'm excited for what's to come in your life. You're not old by any means, so you have tons of life left to live. I think you have a lot of impact left to give and a lot of knowledge to share. If anybody in our audience is listening right now and they want to connect with you and maybe ask you questions or just say hello, where would be a good place for them to find you?
Facebook would be a great place to find me. Nigel Tang, Facebook page. And I think I don't have any other, I'm not too tech savvy or social media savvy. You know, I'm still getting a hang of that sort of thing, but yeah, they can always reach me on Facebook.
Okay. It's Nigel, N-I-G-E-L, Tang, T-A-N-G. Cool dude, if you couldn't tell already. Last question I want to end today's interview with, Nigel. We talked about this a little bit earlier, but we, as a society, people who don't know... Okay, so you're probably the person, you're the only person that in my personal life that I have met and had such a deep conversation about being in prison and about the Reformation and all of that stuff. So now I have a clearer understanding of what it might be like for one man. I feel like society as a whole, they carry a lot of assumptions and judgments about convicts and people who have gone to prison for whatever reason. Can you speak to society's judgments and false assumptions a little bit? What are some things that we should know? What are some things that we assume incorrectly and that you want to correct?
I think that many times society have this perception of us convicts or felons getting out of prison is that they are these people who are lazy, who doesn't want to work. They're still stuck in their criminal ways, like once a criminal, always a criminal, and that we're the worst thing that we committed. Like there's no other side of us, or there's no other good moments. It's like that one thing that we've done eclipse our whole lives, and that's how they view us. But the thing is, that's really not true. I have a few friends similar to me that got out of, you know, like done stuff, amazing stuff. So, you know, and even more than what I've accomplished, and very intelligent, very educated, and very hardworking, and have a really good mindset. And so a lot of times society thinks that, you know, we're just these sort of uneducated, very just, you know, just awful, like just looking for ways to scheme people or something like that. Like just some ill intention all the time. And that isn't true, you know, and I can't say like every one of us are like that, but I hope society knows that there's a lot of us that are not like that. A lot of us just want to work, just want to have a family, just want to be loved, just want to be a contributing member of society, just like you and your neighbors and everyone else. We're not that different from just you and everyone else in the world. You know, I would speak to some of the challenges getting out. For myself, it's been rough. It's been I haven't been able to get my paperwork in order because my father lost my documents. And so my lawyer is helping me to file what they call an N-600 form to get a certificate of citizenship so that I can take that and prove that I am a citizen of this country so that I can go to the DMV to get an ID and eventually get a driver license and get social security card. Because my dad lost these things. And so for someone like me, like while it's great, like my struggle isn't done. You know, I got out of prison, which is great, and now I'm beginning my new chapter. But despite what I'm going through now, I'm determined to not return back to a life of crime. You know, it's been hard, and a lot of time people think that, you know, don't understand that a lot of felons that get out of prison, it's really hard for them to get jobs. And I know that everybody's different. In my case, it's a lot worse than other people's cases, just because of my status. It's really hard to get jobs. A lot of times, a lot of people that I know that just got out of prison, they'll say that they get a job for like maybe 2 weeks, and then the employer finds out like, oh, well, you know, you were in prison and whatnot, and they would get fired or get let go. A lot of times they would say that they they wouldn't get past the interview process. So it's really hard. It's not easy. And it's like, if society wants to, you know, bring down crimes, I think that a way is to find ways to allow people to just go to work, allow people to, because there's a lot of profession that bars convicts from doing certain jobs. And I think that this restriction really caused them a lot of sort of temptation to return to a life of crime. Mm-hmm. It's like no man wants to walk around broke. You know, they want to be able to provide for their family. They want to be able to feel like they contribute to society. They want to be able to feel like they're doing something with their lives. And just getting out of prison, not allowing them to work, really just impedes their ability to rehabilitate, you know. And so if there's any takeaway, I hope that society knows that, you know, we're not these people that when we first went to prison, you know, and we get out the same way. We're not. People grow, people change. I mean, things that they done 10, 15, 20 years ago, they're not the same.
Yeah.
And that hopefully society as a whole can see that we're not the same. And I hope that, you know, employers everywhere would give convicts a chance to be employed.
Yeah, I think that's very important for people to take a step back, because obviously there are cases where they are the same as when they went in, and that's worst case scenario.
Sure.
But I think the problem happens when they take that worst case scenario, because it's all over the news, right? Oh, ex-convict goes and mass murders 100 people. Of course, it's going to be publicized.
Mm-hmm.
But then what you don't see is the ex-convict who got out, he started a family, he got a job, he's contributing to society. I don't know the statistics on this, so don't quote me on it. But I'm guessing that there are at least half of the people that get out and are able to establish a new life are reformed, right?
Yeah.
That's my guess. Again, this is completely just my own brain. But the whole point being is that you can't take what you think is everyone's perspective and make that everyone's perspective. You have to be able to hear the other side, like Nigel's perspective, and recognize that, hey man, this guy's story might be different. He may be in a different place. It's at least worth listening to who they are and what they have to offer. And obviously, Nigel, for you, the last 23, 24, 25 years has been life-altering, to say the least. It's just amazing to see where you've come so far. And as I mentioned before, I'm looking forward to see where you'll be in the next year, 5, 10, 20 years, and how many lives you've impacted. So best of luck to you on that journey.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Thank you, Nigel, for being here with us. Guys, connect with him. I think they say experience is the best teacher. This is a man of experience right here, if you couldn't tell from the conversation. Connect with him, follow him along, ask him questions, teach him about Instagram so he can get on there. If we provided value today, again, let me remind you to go ahead and please share. Nigel, we appreciate your time.
Thank you, Paul.
Everyone else, until next time.